the shadows. "I saw you in Pratt's Arena," he said. "An impressive display indeed. That leap and blow from above, augmented by your entire body weight. The weapon, although just a bar, passed through the dragon's skull like a knife through butter. I think that had it been, let's say, a bear spear or a pike, it would have passed through a male shirt or even plate armor. What do you think?" "It's getting light. It's hard to think when you're feeling drowsy." The man in the shadows snorted. "We shan't dally, then. And let's get to the matter in hand. I need you, you, Witcher, to do a Witcher's job. And it somehow appears that you also need me. Perhaps even more. I'm Prince Xander of Karak. I desire overwhelmingly, to be King Xander the First of Karak. At the moment, to my regret and the detriment of the country, the King of Karak is my father, Belohan. The old buffer is still sound in mind and body, and may reign for 20 more bloody years. I don't have either the time or the desire to wait that long. Why, even if I waited, I couldn't be certain of the succession, since the old fossil may name another successor at any moment. He has an abundant collection of offspring, and is presently applying himself to begetting another. He has planned his royal nuptials with pomp and splendour for the Feast of Lunasa, which the country can ill afford. He, a miser who goes to the park to relieve himself to spare the enamel on his chamber pot, is spending a mountain of gold on the wedding feast, ruining the treasury. I'll be a better king. The crux is that I want to be king at once, as soon as possible, and I need you to achieve that."
"The services I offer don't include carrying out palace revolutions or regicide, and that is probably what your grace has in mind."
"I want to be king, and in order to ascend the throne, my father has to stop being king, and my brothers must be eliminated from the succession."
"Regicide plus fratricide? No, your highness. I have to decline. I regret."
"Not true," the prince snapped from the shadows. "You haven't regretted it yet. Not yet. But you will. I promise you."
"Your royal highness will deign to take note that threatening me with death defeats the purpose."
"Who's talking about death? I'm a prince, not a murderer. I'm talking about a choice. Either my favour or my disfavour. You'll do what I demand, and you'll enjoy my favour. And you absolutely do need it, believe me. Now, with a trial and sentence for a financial swindle awaiting you, it looks as though you'll be spending the next few years at an oar aboard a galley. You thought you'd wriggled out of it, it appears. That your case has already been dismissed. That the witch Nair, who lets you bed her on a whim, will withdraw her accusation, and it'll be over in a trice.
You're mistaken.
Albert Smulka, the Reeve of Ansages, has testified. That testimony incriminates you."
"The testimony is false."
"It will be difficult to prove that."
"Guilt has to be proved, not innocence."
"A good joke. Amusing indeed. But I wouldn't be laughing in your shoes. Take a look at these. They're documents." The prince tossed a sheaf of papers on the table. "Certified testimonies. Witness statements. The town of Sismar. A hired witcher, a Lucrote dispatched. 70 crowns on the invoice. In actual, 55 paid. The difference split with a local pen-pusher. The settlement of Saturnin. A giant spider, killed according to the bill for 90. Actually, according to the alderman's testimony, for 65. A harpy killed in Tybergian. Invoiced for 100 crowns. 70 paid in actuality. And your earlier exploits and rackets. A vampire in Petrel's Sane Castle, which didn't exist at all, and cost the Burgrave a cool 1,000 orins. A werewolf from Guarnes had the spell taken from it, and was magically de-werewolfed for an alleged 100 crowns. A very dubious affair, because it's a bit too cheap for that kind of spell removal. An echinops, or rather something you brought to the alderman in Martin del Campo and called an echinops. Some ghouls from a cemetery near the town of Zagragen, which cost the community 80 crowns, although no one saw any bodies, because they were devoured by, ha-ha, other ghouls. What do you say to that, Witcher? This is proof."
"Your Highness continues to err," Geralt countered. "It isn't proof. They are fabricated slanders. ineptly fabricated to boot. I've never been employed in Tabagian. I haven't even heard of the settlement of Sotonin. Any bills from there are the blatant counterfeits. It won't be hard to prove it. And the ghouls I killed in Zagragan were indeed devoured by, ha-ha, other ghouls, because such are the habits of ghouls. And the corpses buried in that cemetery from then on are decomposing peacefully, because the surviving ghouls have moved out. I don't even want to comment on the rest of the nonsense contained in those documents. A suit will be brought against you on the basis of those documents. The prince placed a hand on them. It will last a long time. Will the evidence turn out to be genuine? Who can say? What verdict will finally be reached? Who cares? It's meaningless. The important thing is the stink that will spread around, and which will trail after you to the end of your days. Some people found you disgusting, but tolerated you out of necessity, as a lesser evil, as the killer of the monsters that threaten them, he continued. Some couldn't bear you as a mutant, felt repulsion and abomination as though to an inhuman creature. Others were terribly afraid of you, and hated themselves for their own fear. All that will sink into oblivion. The renown of an effective killer and the reputation of an evil sorcerer will evaporate like feathers in the wind. The disgust and fear will be forgotten. They will remember you only as an avaricious thief and charlatan. He who yesterday feared you and your spells, who looked away, who spat at the sight of you or reached for an amulet, will tomorrow guffaw and elbow his companions. Look, here comes the witcher, Geralt, that lousy fraudster and swindler. If you don't undertake the task I'm commissioning you with, I'll destroy you, witcher. I'll ruin your reputation, unless you serve me. Decide, yes or no. No. Let it not seem to you that your connections, Theron de Lettenhover, or your red-headed sorceress lover, will help you with anything. The instigator won't risk his own career, and the chapter will forbid the witch from getting involved in a criminal case. No one will help you when the judicial machine entangles you in its gears. I've commanded you to decide, yes or no. No. Definitely no, Your Highness. The man hidden in the bedchamber can come out now. The prince, to Geralt's astonishment, snorted with laughter and slapped a hand on the table. The door creaked and a figure emerged from the adjoining bedchamber. A familiar figure, in spite of the gloom.
"You've won the wager, Theron," said the prince. "Report to my secretary tomorrow for your winnings." "Thank you, Your Princely Grace," Theron de Lettenhover, the royal instigator, replied with a slight bow. "But I treated the wager purely in symbolic terms, to emphasize just how certain I was of being right. I was by no means concerned about the money."
"The money you won," the prince interrupted, "is also a symbol to me, just like the emblem of the Novigradian Mint and the profile of the reigning monarch stamped on it. Know also, both of you, that I have also won. I have regained something I thought was irretrievably lost, namely, faith in people. Geralt of Rivia, Ferrer was absolutely certain of your reaction. I, however, admit that I thought him naive. I was convinced you would yield."
"Everybody's won something," Geralt stated sourly. "And I?"
"You too." The prince became grave.
"Tell him, Ferrer. Enlighten him as to what's at stake here."
"His Grace, Prince Egmund, here present," explained the instigator, "deigned for a moment to impersonate Xander, his younger brother, and also, symbolically, his other brothers, the pretenders to the throne. The prince suspected that Xander or another of his brothers would want to make use of this convenient witcher with the aim of seizing the throne. So we decided to stage this spectacle. And now we know that if it were in fact to occur, should someone indeed make a proposition, you wouldn't be lured into princely favour, or be daunted by threats or blackmail."
"Quite," the witcher nodded.
"And I acknowledge your talent. Your Majesty entered the role splendidly. I didn't detect any artifice in what you deigned to say about me, in the opinion you had of me. On the contrary, I sensed pure frankness."
The masquerade had its objective.
Egmund interrupted the awkward silence. I achieved it and don't intend to account for myself before you. And you will benefit, financially, for I indeed mean to engage you, and reward your services amply. Tell him, Farrell.
Prince Egmund, said the instigator, fears an attempt on the life of his father, King Bellohun, which may happen during the nuptials planned for the Feast of Lunasa. The prince would feel better if at that time somebody, like a witcher, could be responsible for the king's safety. Yes, yes, don't interrupt. We know witchers aren't bodyguards, that their raison d'etre is to defend people from dangerous, magical, supernatural, and unnatural monsters. That's how it is in books.
The prince interrupted impatiently.
In life, it's not so simple. Witchers have been employed to defend caravans, trekking through wildernesses and backwards, teeming with monsters. It has happened, however, that instead of monsters, the merchants were attacked by ordinary robbers, and the witcher's role was not at all to assault their persons, and yet he did. I have grounds to fear that during the nuptials the king may be attacked by the basilisks.
Would you undertake to defend him from basilisks?
That depends.
On what?
On whether this is still a setup. And whether I'm the object of another entrapment, from one of the other brothers, for instance. A talent for impersonation is not, I wager, a rarity in your family.
Feral bristled with rage. Egmund banged a fist on the table.
Watch your step, he snapped, and don't forget yourself. I asked you if you would undertake it. Answer.
I might undertake the defence of the king from hypothetical basilisks,
Geralt nodded.
Unfortunately, my swords were stolen from me in Kerak. The royal services have still not managed to pick up a thief's trail and are probably doing little in that regard. I'm unable to defend anyone without my swords. I must, therefore, decline for practical reasons.
If it is merely a matter of your swords, there's no problem. We shall recover them, shan't we, Lord Instigator?
Absolutely.
You see, the Royal Instigator confirms absolutely.
Well?
Let them first recover the swords. Absolutely.
You're a stubborn character.
But let it be.
I stress that you will receive payment for your services, and I assure you that you won't find me parsimonious.
Regarding other benefits, however, some of them you will gain at once, as an advance, as proof of my goodwill, if you like. You may consider your court case dismissed. The formalities must be carried out, and bureaucracy doesn't recognize the concept of haste, but you may now consider yourself a person free of suspicion, with freedom of movement.
I am inordinately grateful. And the testimonies and invoices? The Lucrot from Sismar, the werewolf from Guames? What about the documents? The ones your Royal Highness deigned to use as theatrical properties.
The documents will remain with me.
Egmund looked him in the eye.
In a safe place. An absolutely safe place.
King Beloan's bell was just striking midnight when he returned. Coral, it ought to be acknowledged, kept calm and reserved. She knew how to control herself. Even her voice didn't change. Well, almost.
Who did that to you?
A vigilosaur. A kind of lizard.
A lizard put in those stitches? You let a lizard stitch you up?
The stitches were put in by a physician, and the lizard...
To hell with the lizard! Mosaic! A scalpel, scissors and tweezers, a needle and catgut, elixir of woundwort, decoction of aloes, unguentum ortolani, a compress and sterile dressing. And prepare a mustard seed and honey poultice. Move, girl!
Mosaic made short work of it. Litter set about the procedure. The witcher sat and suffered in silence.
Physicians who don't know magic ought to be banned from practicing,
drawled the sorceress, putting in the stitches.
Lecture at universities, why not? Sew up corpses after post-mortems, by all means, but they shouldn't be allowed to touch living patients. But I probably won't live to see it. Everything's going the opposite way.
Not only magic heals.
Geralt risked an opinion.
And physicians are necessary. There's only a handful of specialized healing mages, and ordinary sorcerers don't want to heal the sick. They either don't have time or they don't think it worth it.
They think right.
The results of overpopulation may be disastrous.
What's that? That thing you're fiddling with?
The vigilosaur was tagged with it. It had it permanently attached to its hide.
You tore it from it as a trophy deserving of the victor.
I tore it off to show you.
Coral examined the brass oval plate the size of a child's hand and the signs embossed on it.
A curious coincidence, she said,
applying the mustard poultice to his back,
bearing in mind the fact that you're heading that way.
Am I? Oh, yes, true, I'd forgotten. Your confrères and their plans concerning me. Have the plans taken shape, perhaps?
That's right. I've received news. You've been asked to go to Risberg Castle.
Been asked? What an honour. To Risberg, the seat of the renowned Ortolan. A request, I presume, I cannot decline.
I wouldn't advise it. You're asked to go forthwith. Bearing in mind your injuries, when will you be able to set off?
Bearing in mind my injuries, you tell me, physician.
I shall tell you. Later. But now, you won't be around for some time, and I shall miss you. How do you feel now? Will you be able to...
That'll be all, Mozaik. Go to your room and don't disturb us. What's the meaning of that smirk? Am I to freeze it permanently to your mouth?
Interlude. Dandelion. Half a century of poetry. A passage of a rough draft never officially published. Verily, the Witcher was greatly in my debt, more and more every day. The visit to Pyrrol Pratt in Ravlin, which ended, as you know, turbulently and bloodily, brought certain benefits, however. Geralt had picked up the sword thief's trail. It was to my credit, in a way, for it was I, using my cunning, who led Geralt to Ravlin. And the following day it was I, and no other, who fitted Geralt out with a new weapon. I couldn't bear to see him unarmed. You'll say that a witcher is never unarmed, that he is a mutant, well-versed in every form of combat, twice as strong as a normal fellow, and 10 times as fast, who can fell 3 armed thugs with a cooper's oaken stave in no time, that to cap it all he can work magic using his signs, which are no mean weapon. True, but a sword is a sword. He repeated relentlessly that he felt naked without a sword, so I fitted him out with one. Pratt, as you now know, rewarded the Witcher and I financially. None too generously, but I mustn't grumble. The next day, as Geralt had instructed me, I hurried with the check to the Jankardi branch and cashed it. I'm standing there, looking around, and I see that somebody is observing me intently. A lady, not too old, but also not in the first flush of youth, tastefully and elegantly attired. I am no stranger to a lady's delighted look. Plenty of women find my manly and wolfish features irresistible. The lady suddenly walks over and introduces herself as Etna Azida, and claims to know me. Huh, what a thing. Everybody knows me. My fame precedes me wherever I go.
"News has reached me, my lord poet," she says, "about the unfortunate accident that befell your comrade the Witcher, Geralt of Rivia. I know he has lost his weapons and is in urgent need of new ones, and I am also aware that a good sword is hard to find. It so happens that I possess one, left by my deceased husband, may the gods have mercy upon his soul. At this very moment I've come to the bank to sell the sword, for what could a widow want with a sword? The bank has valued it and wants to take it on a commission basis, while I, nonetheless, am in urgent need of ready coin, for I needs must pay the debts of the deceased, otherwise my creditors will torment me. Thus..." Upon which the lady picks up a roll of damask and unwraps a sword from it. A marvel, let me tell you, light as a feather, the scabbard tasteful and elegant, the hilt of lizard's skin, the cross-guard gilt, with a jasper the size of a pigeon's egg in the pommel. I draw it, and can't believe my eyes. A punch in the shape of the sun on the blade, just above the cross-guard, and just beyond it, the inscription, "Draw me not without reason, sheathe me not without honour," meaning the blade was wrought in the Nilfgaardian city of Viruleda, a place famous throughout the world for its armourer's forges. I touch the blade with the tip of my thumb, razor sharp, I swear.
Since I'm nobody's fool, I betray nothing. I look on indifferently as the bank clerks bustle around and some poor old woman polishes the brass doorknobs.
The Jancardi's bank, quoth the little widow, valued the sword at 200 crowns, for official sale. But for cash in hand, I'll part with it for 150.
Ho, ho, I reply. 150 is a deal of money. You can buy a house for that. A small one, in the suburbs.
Oh, Lord Dandelion,
the woman wrings her hands, shedding a tear.
You're mocking me. You are a cruel fellow, sir, to take advantage of a widow so. Since I am trapped, so be it. 100.
And thus, my dears, I solved the witch's problem. I scurry off to the Crab and Garfish. Geralt is already sitting there over his bacon and scrambled eggs. No doubt there was white cheese and chives for breakfast at the red-headed witch's. I stride up and, clang, I slam the sword down on the table, dumbfounding him. He drops his spoon, draws the weapon from the scabbard, and examines it. His countenance stony. But I am accustomed to his mutant state, and know that emotions have no effect on him. No matter how delighted or happy he might be, he doesn't betray it.
How much did you give for it?
I wished to answer that it wasn't his business, but I recalled in time that I had paid with his money, so I confessed. He squeezed my arm, didn't say a word, the expression on his face unchanged. That is him all over, simple but sincere. And he told me he was setting off, alone.
I'd like you to stay in Carrack.
He anticipated my protests.
And keep your eyes and ears open.
He told me what had happened the previous day, about his evening conversation with Prince Egmund, and fidgeted with the Viridian sword the whole time, like a child with a new toy.
I don't mean to serve the Duke, he recapitulated, nor participate in the royal nuptials in August in the role of bodyguard. Egmund and your cousin are certain they will seize the sword thief forthwith. I don't share their optimism, and that usually suits me. With my swords, Egmund would have an advantage over me. I prefer to catch the thief myself in Novigrad in July, before the auction at the Borsodis. I'd get my swords back, and I wouldn't show my face in Kerak again. And you, Dandelion, keep your mouth shut. No one can know what Pratt told us, no one, including your cousin the Instigator.
I promised to be as silent as the grave, while he looked at me strangely, quite as though he didn't trust me.
And because anything might happen, he continued, I must have an alternative plan. I'd like to know as much as possible about Egmund and his siblings, about all the possible pretenders to the throne, about the king himself, about the whole dear royal family. I'd like to know what they're planning and plotting, who's in with whom, what factions are active here and so on. Is that clear?
You don't want to involve Litanir in this, I gather, I responded. And rightly so, I think. The red-haired beauty certainly has perfect insight into the matters interesting you. But the local monarchy binds her too much for her to consider double loyalty, for one thing. And for another, don't let on that you'll soon flee and won't be showing up again, because her reaction may be violent. Sorceresses, as you found out directly, don't like it when people disappear. As regards the rest, I promised, you can count on me. I shall have my ears and eyes in readiness and directed at where they're needed. And I've become acquainted with the dear local royal family and heard enough gossip. Our gracious King Belohan has produced numerous offspring. He has changed his wife quite often. Whenever he spots a new one, the old one conveniently bids farewell to this world by an unfortunate twist of fate, suddenly falling into infirmity, in the face of which medicine turns out to be impotent. In this way, the king has 4 legal sons today, each one with a different mother, not counting his innumerable daughters, as they can't pretend to the throne. All bastards. It's worth mentioning, however, that all the significant positions and offices in Carrack are filled by his daughter's husbands. My cousin Ferron is an exception, and his illegitimate sons manage commerce and industry. The Witcher, I heed, is listening attentively. The 4 legitimate sons, I go on, are, in order of seniority, the firstborn, whose name I don't know, it's forbidden to mention his name at court. After a quarrel with his father, he went away and disappeared without trace. No one has seen him since. The second, Elmer, is a deranged drunk kept under lock and key. It's supposedly a state secret, but in Kerak it's common knowledge. Egmund and Xander are the real pretenders. They detest each other, and Beloan exploits it cunningly, keeping both of them in a state of permanent uncertainty.
In matters of the succession, he is also often capable of ostentatiously favouring one of the bastards and tantalising him with promises. Whereas now it's whispered in dark corners that he has promised the crown to the son to be born by his new wife, the one he's officially marrying at Lunasa. Cousin Ferron and I think, however, that they are but fine words, I continue, used by the old prick with the intention of stirring the young thing to sexual fervour, since Egmont and Xander are the only true heirs to the throne. And if it comes to a coup d'etat, it'll be carried out by one of the two. I've met them both through my cousin. They are both, I had the impression, as slippery as turds in mayonnaise, if you know what I mean. Geralt confirmed he knew, and that he had the same impression when he spoke to Egmont, only he was unable to express it in such beautiful words. Then he pondered deeply.
"I'll return soon," he finally said. "And you, don't sit around and keep an eye on things."
"Before we say farewell," I responded, "be a good chap and tell me something about your witch's pupil. The one with the slicked-down hair. She's a true rosebud. All she needs is a little work, and she'll bloom wonderfully. So I've decided that I'll devote myself." Geralt's face, however, changed. Without warning, he slammed his fist down on the table, making the mugs jump.
"Keep your paws well away from us, like Bosca,"
he started on me without a trace of respect.
"Knock that idea out of your head. Don't you know that sorceresses' pupils are strictly prohibited from even the most innocent flirting? For the smallest offence of that kind, Coral will decide she's not worth teaching and send her back to the school, which is an awful embarrassment and loss of face for a pupil. I've heard of suicides caused by that, and there's no fooling around with Coral. She doesn't have a sense of humour."
I felt like advising her to try tickling her with a hen's feather in her intergluteal cleft, for such a measure can cheer up even the greatest of sourpusses, but I said nothing, for I know him. He can't bear anyone to talk tactlessly about his women, even brief dalliances. Thus, I swore on my honour that I would strike the slicked-down novice's chastity from the agenda and not even woo her.
"If that stings you so much," he said brightly as he was leaving, "then know that I met a lady lawyer in the local court. She looked willing. Pursue her instead."
"Not on your life! What, does he expect me to bed the judiciary? Although, on the other hand..."
Interlude. Highly Honourable Madam, Litanir, Kerak, Upper Town, Villa Sicklemon, Risberg Castle, 1st of July, 1245, P.R. Dear Coral, I trust my letter finds you in good health and mood, and that everything is as you wish. I hasten to inform you that the Witcher, called Geralt of Rivia, finally deigned to put in an appearance at our castle. Immediately after arriving in less than an hour, he showed himself to be annoyingly unbearable, and managed to alienate absolutely everyone, including the Reverend Ortolan, a person who could be regarded as kindness personified, and favourably disposed to everyone. The opinions circulating about that individual aren't, as it turns out, exaggerated in even the tiniest respect, and the antipathy and hostility that he encounters everywhere have their own deep-seated grounds. But, however, insomuch as esteem should be paid him, I shall be the first to do so, sine ira et studio. The fellow is every inch the professional, and totally trustworthy as regards his trade. There can be no doubt that he executes whatever he attempts, or falls trying to achieve it. We may thus consider the goal of our enterprise accomplished, mainly thanks to you, dear Coral. We express our thanks to you for your efforts, and you shall find us, as always, grateful. You, meanwhile, have my especial gratitude. As your old friend, mindful of what we have shared, I, more than the others, understand your sacrifice. I realize how you must have suffered the proximity of that individual who is indeed an amalgam of the vices you cannot bear. Cynicism derived from a profound complex with a pompous and introvert nature, an insincere character, a primitive mind, mediocre intelligence, and great arrogance. I pass over the fact that he has ugly hands and chipped fingernails in order not to irritate you, dear Coral. After all, I know you detest such things. But, as it's been said before, an end has come to your suffering, troubles, and distress. Nothing now stands in the way of your breaking off relations with that individual,
and ceasing all contact with him. In the process, definitively putting an end to and making a stand against the false slander spread by unfriendly tongues that have brazenly tried to turn your, let's be honest, simulated and feigned kindness to the Witcher into a vulgar affair. But enough of that. It's not worth belaboring the point. I'd be the happiest of people, my dear Coral, if you were to visit me in Risberg. I don't have to add that one word of yours, one gesture, one smile is enough for me to hasten to you as quickly as I might. Yours with heartfelt respect, Pinity. P.S. The unfriendly tongues I mentioned posit that your favour towards the Witcher comes from a desire to annoy your consoror, Yennefer, who is still said to be interested in the Witcher. The naivety and ignorance of those schemers is indeed pitiful, since it is widely known that Yennefer is in an ardent relationship with a certain young entrepreneur from the jewellery trade, and she cares as much about the Witcher and his transient love affairs as she does about last year's snow. Interlude. The highly honourable Lord Algernon Gwyncamp, Risberg Castle, ex urbe Kerak, die 5 mens, jule anno 1245 PR. My dear Pinity, thanks for the letter. You haven't written to me in ages. Why, there clearly has been nothing to write about or any reason to do so. Your concern about my health and mood is endearing, also about whether things go as I would wish. I inform you with satisfaction that everything is turning out as it ought, and I'm sparing no effort in that regard. Every man, as you know, steers his own ship. Please note that I steer my ship with a sure hand through squalls and reefs, holding my head high whenever the storm rages around. As far as my health is concerned, everything is in order, as a matter of fact. Not only physically, but psychologically too, for some little time since I've had what I'd long been lacking. I only realized how much I was missing it when I stopped missing it. I'm glad the enterprise requiring the Witcher's participation is heading towards success. My modest contribution in the enterprise fills me with pride. Your sorrow is needless, my dear Pinity. If you think it involved suffering, sacrifices and difficulties, it wasn't quite so bad. Geralt is indeed a veritable conglomeration of vices. I nevertheless also uncovered in him, sine ira et studio, virtues. Considerable ones, at that. I vouch that many a man, were he to know, would worry, and many would envy. We have become accustomed to the gossip, rumours, tall tales and intrigues of which you write, my dear Pinity. We know how to cope with them, and the method is simple. Ignore them. I'm sure you recall the gossip about you and Sabrina Glevisig when it was rumoured there was something between us. I ignored it. I advise you to do the same now. Bene vale, Coral. P.S. I'm extremely busy. A potential rendezvous seems impossible for the foreseeable future. They wander through various lands, and their tastes and moods demand that they be sans all dependencies. That means they recognize not any authority, human or divine. They respect not any laws or principles. They believe themselves innocent of and uncontaminated by any obedience. Being fraudsters by nature, they live by divinations with which they deceive simple folk, serve as spies, distribute counterfeit amulets, fraudulent medicaments, stimulants and narcotics, also dabble in harlotry. That is, they supply paying customers with lewd maidens for filthy pleasures. When they know poverty, they are not ashamed to beg or commit common theft, but they prefer swindles and fraud. They delude the naive that they supposedly protect people, that supposedly they kill monsters for the sake of folk's safety. But that is a lie. Long ago was it proven that they do it for their own amusement, for killing is a first-rate diversion to them. In preparing for their work, they make certain magic spells, howbeit it is but to delude the eyes of observers. Devout priests at once uncovered the falsity and jiggery-pokery to the confusion of those devil servants who call themselves witchers. Anonymous. Monstrum, or A Description of Witches. Chapter 9. Risberg looked neither menacing nor impressive. There it was, a small castle like many others, of average size, elegantly built into the mountain's steep sides, hugging a cliff, its bright wall contrasting with the evergreen of a spruce forest, the tiles of two quadrangular towers, one tall, the other lower, overlooking the treetops. The wall surrounding the castle wasn't, as it transpired from close up, too tall, and wasn't topped by battlements, while the small towers positioned at the corners and over the gatehouse were more decorative than defensive. The road meandering around the hill bore the signs of intensive use, for it was used, and used intensively. The Witcher was soon overtaking carts, carriages, lone riders and pedestrians. Plenty of travellers were also moving in the opposite direction, away from the castle. Geralt guessed at the destination of these pilgrimages, which was proved correct, it turned out, after he'd only just left the forest. The flat hilltop beneath the curtain of the wall was occupied by a small town built of timber, reeds and straw, an entire complex of large and small buildings, and roofs surrounded by a fence and enclosures for horses and livestock. There was a hubbub and people moved around briskly, like at a market or a fair. For it was indeed a fair, a bazaar, an open market, except neither poultry, fish, nor vegetables were traded there. The goods on sale below the castle were magic. Amulets, talismans, elixirs, opiates, filters, decocts, extracts, distillates, concoctions, incense, syrups, scents, powders and ointments, as well as various practical and enchanted objects, tools, domestic equipment, decorations, and even children's toys. The whole assortment attracted purchases in great numbers. There was demand, there was supply, and business was clearly flourishing. The road divided. The Witcher headed along the path leading towards the castle gate, considerably less rutted than the other, which led the buyers towards the marketplace. He rode across the cobbled area in front of the gatehouse, along an avenue of menhirs, specially set there, mostly considerably taller than him on his horse. He was soon greeted by a gate, more suited to a palace than a castle, decorated with pilasters and a pediment. The witch's medallion vibrated powerfully. Roach neighed, her horseshoes clattering on the cobbles, and stopped abruptly.
"Identity and purpose of visit."
He raised his head. A rasping and echoing voice, undoubtedly female, seemed to emerge from the wide-open mouth of the harpy's head depicted on the tympanum. His medallion quivered, and the mare snorted. Geralt felt a strange tightness at the temples.
"Identity and purpose of visit,"
came the voice from the hole in the relief, a little louder than before. "Geralt of Rivia, Witcher, I'm expected." The harpy's head uttered a sound resembling a trumpet call. The magic blocking the portal vanished. The pressure at his temples stopped at once, and the mare set off without being urged. Her hooves clattered on the stones. He rode from the portal into a cul-de-sac ringed by a cloister. Two servants, boys in practical brown and grey attire, ran over to him at once. One attended to the horse, and the other served as a guide.
"This way, Zaya."
"Is it always like this here? Such a commotion? Down there in the suburbs?"
"No, Zaya."
The servant threw a frightened glance at him.
"No, but on Wednesdays. Wednesday's market day."
On the arcaded finial of the next portal was a cartouche bearing another relief, undoubtedly also magical, depicting an Amphisbaena's maw. The portal was closed off by an ornate, solid-looking grill, which, however, opened easily and smoothly when the servant pushed against it. The next courtyard was significantly larger, and the castle could only be properly admired from there. The view from a distance, it turned out, was very deceptive. Risberg was much larger than it appeared to be. A complex of severe and unsightly buildings, seldom encountered in castle architecture, extended deep into the mountain wall. The buildings looked like factories, and probably were, for there were chimneys and ventilation pipes protruding from them. The smell of burning sulphur and ammonia was in the air, and the ground trembled slightly, proof that some kind of subterranean machinery was in operation. A cough from the servant drew Geralt's attention away from the industrial complex, for they were supposed to be going the other way, towards the lower of the two towers, rising above the buildings with more classical architecture befitting a palace. The interior also turned out to be typical of a palace. It smelled of dust, wood, wax, and old junk. It was bright, magic balls veiled in halos of light, The standard illumination of sorcerers' dwelling places floated beneath the ceiling, as languid as fish in an aquarium.
Welcome, Witcher.
The welcome party turned out to be two sorcerers. He knew them both, although not personally. Yennefer had once pointed out Harland Zara to him, and Geralt remembered him because he was probably the only mage to cultivate a completely shaven head. He remembered the other, Algernon Gwyncup, called Pinnity, from the academy in Oxenfurt.
Welcome to Risberg, Pinnity greeted him. We're glad you agreed to come.
Are you mocking me? I'm not here of my own will. In order to force me to come, Litanair shoved me in the clink.
But she extracted you later, interrupted Zara, and rewarded you amply. She made good your discomfort with great devotion. Word has it that you've been enjoying her company for at least a week.
Geralt fought the overwhelming urge to punch him in the face. Pinnity must have noticed it. Pax! He raised a hand. Pax, Harlan. Let's end these squabbles. Let's give this battle of snide remarks and acerbities a miss. We know Geralt has something against us. It's audible in every word he utters. We know why that is. We know how the affair with Yennefer saddened him, and the reaction of the wizarding community to the affair. We shan't change that. But Geralt is a professional. He will know how to rise above it.
He will, Geralt admitted caustically. But the question is whether he'll want to. Can we finally get to the point? Why am I here?
We need you, said Zara dryly. You in particular.
Me in particular? Ought I to feel honoured, or to start feeling afraid?
You are celebrated, Geralt of Rivia, said Pinnity. Your deeds and exploits are indeed regarded, by general consensus, as spectacular and admirable. You may not especially count on our admiration as you conclude. We aren't so inclined to show our esteem particularly to someone like you, but we're able to acknowledge professionalism and respect experience. The facts speak for themselves. You are, I dare say, an outstanding...
Yes?
Eliminator.
Pinnity found the word without difficulty. He had clearly prepared it in advance. Someone who eliminates monsters and beasts that endanger people. Geralt made no comment. He waited.
Our aim, the aim of all sorcerers, is also people's prosperity and safety. Thus, we may talk of a community of interests. Occasional misunderstandings ought not to obscure that. The lord of this castle gave us to understand that not long ago. He is aware of you, and would like to meet you personally. That is his wish.
Ortolan?
Grand Master Ortolan, and his closest collaborators. You will be introduced later. The servants will show you to your quarters. You may refresh yourself after your journey. Rest. We'll send for you soon.
Geralt pondered. He recalled everything he had ever heard about Grandmaster Ortolan, who was, as general consensus had it, a living legend. Ortolan was a living legend, a person who had rendered extraordinary service to the magic arts. His obsession was the popularization of magic. Unlike the majority of sorcerers, he thought that the benefits and advantages deriving from supernatural powers ought to be a common good, and serve to strengthen universal prosperity, comfort, and general bliss. It was Ortolan's dream that everybody ought to have guaranteed free access to magical elixirs and medicaments. Magical amulets, talismans, and every kind of artifact ought to be universally and freely available. Telepathy, telekinesis, teleportation, and telecommunication ought to be the privilege of every citizen. In order to achieve that, Ortolan was endlessly coming up with things, meaning inventions, some just as legendary as he himself. Reality painfully challenged the venerable sorcerer's fantasies. None of his inventions, intended to popularize and democratize magic, moved beyond the prototype phase. Everything that Ortolan thought up, and what in principle ought to have been simple, turned out to be horrendously complicated. Everything that was meant to be mass-produced turned out to be devilishly expensive. But Ortolan didn't lose heart, and instead of discouraging him, The fiascos aroused him to greater efforts, leading to further fiascos. It was suspected, although naturally this never dawned on Ortolan himself, that the cause of the inventor's failures was often sheer sabotage. It wasn't caused by, well, not just by the simple envy of the Sorcerer's Brotherhood, the reluctance to popularize the art of magic, which sorcerers and sorceresses preferred to see in the hands of the elite, i.e. their own. The fears were more about inventions of a military and lethal nature. And the fears were justified. Like every inventor, Ortolan had phases of fascination with explosive and flammable materials. Siege catapults, armored chariots, crude firearms, sticks that hit by themselves and poison gases. Universal peace among nations is a condition of prosperity, the old man tried to prove, and peace is achieved by arming oneself. The most certain method of preventing wars is to have a terrible weapon as a deterrent. The more terrible it is, the more enduring and certain the peace. Because Ortolan wasn't accustomed to listening to arguments, saboteurs who torpedoed his dangerous inventions were hidden among his inventing team. Almost none of the inventions saw the light of day. An exception was the notorious missile hurler, the subject of numerous anecdotes. It was a kind of telekinetic arbalest with a large container for lead missiles. This missile hurler, as the name suggested, was meant to throw missiles at a target in whole series. The prototype made it out of Risberg's walls, astonishingly, and it was even tested in some skirmish or other. With pitiful results, however. The artilleryman, using the invention, when asked about the weapon's usefulness, apparently said that the missile hurler was like his mother-in-law. Heavy, ugly, totally useless, and only fit to be taken and thrown in a river. The old sorcerer wasn't upset when this was relayed to him. The weapon was a toy, he was said to have declared, and he already had many more advanced projects on his drawing board capable of mass destruction. He, Ortolan, would give humanity the benefit of peace, even if it would first be necessary to destroy half of it. The wall of the chamber where he was led was graced by a huge tapestry, a masterpiece of weaving of Arcadian verdure. The tapestry was marred by a stain, somewhat resembling a large squid that hadn't been completely washed off. Someone, thought the Witcher, must have puked up on the masterpiece not long before. Seven people were seated at a long table occupying the center of the chamber. Master Ortolan, Pinity bowed slightly, let me introduce to you Geralt of Rivia, the Witcher. Ortolan's appearance didn't surprise Geralt. It was believed he was the world's oldest living sorcerer. Perhaps that was really true. Perhaps not. But the fact remained that Ortolan was the oldest-looking sorcerer. This was strange insofar as Ortolan was the inventor of a celebrated mandrake decoction, an elixir used by sorcerers in order to arrest the aging process. Ortolan himself, when he had finally developed a reliably acting formula for the magical liquid, didn't gain much benefit from it, because by then he was quite advanced in age. The elixir prevented aging, but by no means rejuvenated. For which reason Ortolan too, although he had used the remedy for a long time, continued to look like an old codger, particularly when compared to his confrères, venerable sorcerers who resembled men in the prime of life, and his consorors, world-weary sorceresses who looked like maids. The sorceresses, bursting with youth and charm, and the slightly grey-haired sorcerers, whose real dates of birth had vanished in the mists of time, jealously guarded the secrets of Ortolan's elixir, and sometimes quite simply even denied its existence. Meanwhile, they kept Ortolan convinced that the elixir was generally available, owing to which humanity was practically immortal and, consequently, absolutely happy.
"Geralt of Rivia,"
repeated Ortolan, crushing a tuft of his grey beard in his hand.
"Indeed, indeed, we have heard. The Witcher? A defender, they say. A guardian, protecting people from evil. A prophylactic agent and esteemed antidote to all fearsome evil."
Geralt assumed a modest expression and bowed.
"Indeed, indeed," continued the mage, tugging at his beard. "We know, according to all testimony. You spare not your strength to defend folk, my boy. You spare it not. And your practice is verily estimable. Your craft is estimable. We welcome you to our castle, content that the fates brought you here. For though you may not know it yourself, you have returned like a bird to its nest. Verily, like a bird. We are glad to see you, and trust that you are also glad to see us, eh?
Geralt was undecided about how to address Ortolan. Sorcerers didn't recognize polite forms and didn't expect them from others. But he didn't know if that was acceptable with regard to a grey-haired and grey-bearded old man and a living legend to boot. Instead of speaking, he bowed again. Pinity introduced the sorcerers seated at the table in turn. Geralt had heard of some of them. The forehead and cheeks of Axel Esparza, more widely known as Pockmarked Axel, were indeed covered with pitted scars. He hadn't removed them, so went the rumour, out of sheer contrariness. The slightly grizzled Miles Trevethy and slightly more grizzled Stukud Zanjanis examined the Witcher with moderate interest. The interest of Biruta Ikarti, a moderately attractive blonde, seemed a little greater. Tarvix Sandoval, broad-shouldered, a physique more befitting a knight than a sorcerer, looked to one side at the tapestry, as though he was also admiring the stain, and was wondering where it came from and who was responsible for it. The seat nearest Ortolan was occupied by Sorel Degelund, apparently the youngest of those present, whose long hair lent him a slightly effeminate look.
"We too welcome the famous Witcher, the defender of folk," said Biruta Ikarti. "We are glad to welcome you, since we also toil in this castle under the auspices of Grand Master Ortolan, in order that, thanks to progress, we will make people's lives safer and easier. People's best interests are our overriding goal, too. The Grand Master's age doesn't permit us overly to prolong the audience. Thus, I shall ask what is appropriate. Do you have any wishes, Geralt of Rivia? Is there something we can do for you?"
"I thank you, Grand Master Ortolan." Geralt bowed again. "And you, distinguished sorceress. And since you embolden me with the question, yes, there is something you could do for me. You could enlighten me. About this. This thing. I tore it from a vigilosaur I killed."
He placed on the table the oval plate the size of a child's hand, with characters embossed on it.
"Rispies Rep Mark 4 /002025.
Pockmarked Axel read aloud, and passed the plate to Sandoval.
"It's a mutation, created here by us at Risberg," Sandoval stated bluntly. "In the pseudo-reptile section. It's a guard lizard. Mark 4, Series 2, Specimen 25. Obsolete. We've been manufacturing an improved model for a long time. What else needs explaining?"
"He says he killed the Vigilosaur,"
Stukko Sanjanis grimaced.
"So it's not about an explanation, but a claim. We only accept and look into complaints, Witcher, from legal buyers, and only on the basis of proof of purchase. We only service and remove defects on the basis of proof of purchase."
"That model's guarantee expired long ago," added Miles Trevethy. "And anyway, no guarantee covers defects resulting from inappropriate use of the product, or in breach of the operating instructions. If the product was used inappropriately, Risberg doesn't take responsibility of any kind."
"And do you take responsibility for this?"
Geralt took another plate from his pocket and threw it down on the table. The other plate was similar in shape and size to the previous one, but darkened and tarnished. Dirt had become embedded and fused into the grooves, but the characters were still legible. IDR ULX 9-0012 Beta. A long silence fell.
"Idaren of Ulivo," Pinity said at last, surprisingly quietly and surprisingly hesitantly. "One of Altsur's students. I never expected."
"Where did you get it, Witcher?"
Pockmarked Axel leaned across the table.
"How did you come by it?"
"You ask as though you didn't know," retorted Geralt. I dug it out of the carapace of a creature I killed. One that had murdered at least 20 people in the district. At least 20. For I think it was many more. I think it had been killing for years.
Idaran, muttered Tarvik Sandoval. And before him, Malaspina and Altsur.
But it wasn't us, said Sanjanis. It wasn't us, not Risberg.
Experimental Model 9, added Biruta Ikati pensively. Beta version. Specimen 12.
Specimen 12, Geralt chimed in, not without spitefulness. And how many were there altogether? How many were manufactured? I won't be getting an answer to my question about responsibility, that's clear, because it wasn't you, it wasn't Risberg. You're clean, and you want me to believe that. But at least tell me, because you surely know how many of them there are wandering around in forests, murdering people. How many of them will have to be found and hacked to death? I meant to say eliminated.
What is it? What is it?
Ortolan suddenly became animated.
What do you have there? Show me. Ah.
Sorrel Dagerland leaned over towards the old man's ear and whispered for a long time. Miles Trevevi, showing him the plate, whispered from the other side. Ortolan tugged at his beard.
Killed it?
He suddenly shouted in a high, thin voice.
The Witcher destroyed Idaran's work of genius. Killed it. Unthinkingly destroyed it.
The Witcher couldn't control himself. He snorted. His respect for advanced age and grey hair suddenly abandoned him altogether. He snorted again, and then laughed, heartily and relentlessly. The stony faces of the sorcerers sitting at the table, rather than restraining him, made him even more amused. By the devil, he thought. I don't remember when I last laughed so heartily. Probably in Caer Morhen, he recalled. Yes, in Caer Morhen, when that rotten plank broke underneath Vesemir in the privy.
He's still laughing, the pup,
cried out Ortolan.
He's neighing like an ass. Doltish whippersnapper. To think I came to your defence when others vilified you. So what if he has become enamoured of little Yennefer, I said. And what if little Yennefer dotes on him? The heart is no servant, I said. Leave them both in peace.
Geralt stopped laughing.
And what have you done? Most stupid of assassins, the old man yelled. What did you do? Do you comprehend what a work of art? What a miracle of genetics you have ruined? No, no, you cannot conceive of that with your shallow mind, layman. You cannot comprehend the ideas of brilliant people, such as Idaran and Altsur, his teacher, who were graced with genius and extraordinary talent, who invented and created great works, meant to serve humanity without taking profit, nor taking base mammon into account, not recreation, nor diversion, but solely progress and the common weal. But what can you apprehend of such things? You apprehend nothing, 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 not a scrap. And indeed, I tell you further,
Ortolan panted,
that you have dishonored the work of your own fathers with this impudent murder. For it was Cosimo Malaspina, and after him his student Altsor, yes, Altsor, who created the witches. They invented the mutation owing to which men like you were bred. Owing to which you exist. Owing to which you walk upon this earth, ungrateful one. You ought to esteem, Altsur, his successes and their works, and not destroy them. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
The old sorcerer suddenly fell silent, rolled his eyes and groaned heavily.
I needs must to the stool,
he announced plaintively.
I needs must quickly to the stool. Sorrow, my dear boy.
Dagerlund and Trevevi
leapt up from their seats, helped the old man up, and led him out of the chamber. A short while after, Biruta Ikati stood up. She threw the witch